Hey friends, welcome back to the Journal Feed. My name is Nick Zelt, and this is the only place to get spoon-fed the latest and the greatest of emergency medicine. Here we have articles appraised and concisely summarized for your benefit. I'm currently on vacation, so any change in the audio quality is just what it's going to be this week. If you are hearing this right now, then you are not currently a Journal Feed subscriber, and so will not be receiving the full Journal Feed podcast, only receiving a portion of the past week's articles. Don't worry, they're all good articles, but if you would like to get full access to both the podcast and the blog, then you'll have to become a member. All the details for that are at journalfeed.org. And remember that we never want money to be a barrier to better patient care, so if you're having any trouble affording a subscription, reach out, we'll help you out. Now, this is the audio version of our past week summaries, which this week were brought to you by our authors, Clark Strunk, Ketan Patel, Charles Worth, Rebecca White, myself, and Clay Smith. Let's jump straight to the second article, titled Spiced RCT, Success and Pain Associated with Intravenous Cannulation in the Emergency Department, a Randomized Controlled Trial, out of the Journal of Emergency Medicine. Few are the number of patients who pass through our doors without being punctured or skewered by some kind of needle. We accept this as a necessary evil. But since we've already failed at the sort of do-no-harm aspect of medicine by stabbing them for their own benefit, I feel that we are duty-bound to extract the maximal value from the cannulas that we do insert. I'm talking about fluid flow rates here when comparing the merits of one cannula over another. Logically, one might assume that a larger needle would be more painful to put in and more difficult to insert. But medicine, it's not really that logical most of the time. These authors conducted a single-blinded comparative RCT in an Australian emergency department, and adult patients were randomized to receive either a 20-gauge or an 18-gauge IV cannula. 181 patients were blinded, literally blinded with blackout glasses, to which cannula was being used on them. The primary outcomes were pain experienced by the patient, and the procedural difficulty experienced by the clinician who was inserting the cannula, both assessed on a visual analog scale. Now for some results. The overall success rate for cannula insertion on the first try or on the first three tries was not significantly different between the 20-gauge and the 18-gauge. Mean pain scores were also similar, mean difference of 0.23 on a 10-point scale. That was a p-value of 0.57, so not significant. This lack of difference held true across all experience levels for those people who were actually putting in the cannulas. That's from medical student to registrar. Although overall pain was less with the more experience that you had in putting in the needle. Similar procedural difficulty was also not significantly different between the groups. So how is this going to change my practice? It seems that in Australia, doctors place the majority of IVs. It's not common for me to actually insert an IV myself unless all others have failed, and then I'm just going to place one under ultrasound guidance because people better than me have already failed. Also, the preferred cannulation site in this trial was the antecubital fossa, while most of my patients end up with IVs in their hands. All the same, this paper will make me way less sheepish about always reaching for the larger cannula as I already do. If I'm going to put an IV, I put in the biggest, longest cannula I can find. And I will also advocate for others to do the same. In a spoonful, this single-center RCT investigated the link between IV cannula diameter and how painful it is to insert. 18-gauge cannulas were not more painful nor more difficult to place than 20-gauge cannulas across the spectrum of experience levels. Pain and insertion success rates being equal, patients are probably better off with cannulas that can accommodate higher flow rates. Just in case. And then we skip to the fifth article, titled The Effect of Bougie Use on First Attempt Success in Tracheal Intubations, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, out of the Annals of Emergency Medicine. Alright guys, we're back to the bougie debate. It's felt like it's been sleeping on us for quite a few years now. I actually hadn't heard much about it in a while, but nothing is safe from multiple meta-analyses to flip-flop around what we think the right answer actually is. Now, this was a well-done CIRMA. It collected 18 studies, 12 of them being RCTs, to total more than 9,000 patients comparing normal intubations, done as you please, to the bougie first approach. Most intubations occurred pre-hospital, in the emergency department, or in the ICU. More than half of the studies, 61%, used direct laryngoscopy, and the rest used standard geometry video laryngoscopy. None of the studies were considered low risk of bias, none of the studies, and the authors' overall conclusions were made with low certainty. And what were those conclusions? Well, Bushi wins. The Bushi first approach had significantly increased rates of first attempt success. A confidence interval on the risk ratio from 1.06 to 1.17, constant in all practice environments that were subgrouped. The effect was even more pronounced for difficult airways, a risk ratio of 1.6. Sadly, when they subgrouped for emergency intubations, they lost their significant difference, though that was based only on 3 RCTs. There were a few pre-planned analyses summed up to say that there was no significant change in hypoxemia, esophageal intubations, or post-intubation cardiac arrests. As you might expect, it takes slightly longer to intubate with a Bushi, and there was a slight increase in the number of oral injuries related to Bushi intubations. The authors conclude to recommend that Bushis should probably be used first line rather than as a rescue device. Now, given the risks of bias and the low certainty of these findings, it seems a bit heavy to recommend that Bushi necessarily be the norm. Quite frankly, it seems like you're adding steps to many intubations that would otherwise be very straightforward, and then you could make more mistakes than you save. That's just my thoughts on it. Also, first pass success isn't necessarily a patient-centered outcome. So, on top of all that uncertainty, we're also using a surrogate marker. You should also consider the harms that would be caused by having people who seldom or never use Bushis switching to a Bushi-first approach. There's a learning curve there that could certainly cause harm. The real benefit would be teaching all new learners to always use a Bushi, rather than trying to get the old guard to switch over, I'd say. I personally think that having a Bushi readily on hand, and that being your approach, is probably an equivalent method. If you see the cords and it's straightforward, then I honestly see no benefit to placing a Bushi, except as practice. I understand that, I get it. I suppose it's good to practice, even when you don't need the Bushi, but still. Really though, if no one has mandated that you use video laryngoscopy, then no one is going to force you to use a Bushi either. In a spoonful, in the systematic review and meta-analysis, to evaluate the use of Bushi versus non-Bushi approaches, i.e. just a stylet, in intubations of adult patients, a Bushi-first approach significantly increased the rate of first attempt success compared with controls. Alright, that's all the articles we have for this week. Let's do a quick recap. From the second article, larger IVs don't hurt more. And at least if you're shooting for decent-sized veins like these guys did in the antecubital fossa, then they're not harder to put in either. Might as well go for the 18 gauge instead of the 20. And then from the fifth article, the latest meta-analysis recommends the Bushi-first approach for all intubations, though there isn't a lot of certainty to back up that recommendation. Again, if you were hearing this right now, then you are not currently a Journal Feed subscriber, and so you missed the 3 articles from this past week. What were those articles about? Well, one is about, do paperclips really need to be placed in penetrating trauma patients? Second, a recap of the top OCA articles from 2023. And then third was the rates of serious bacterial infections in preterm infants. Are they different from term infants? Links to all the original articles can be found at journalfeed.org, or you can just follow the links in the show notes. Our goal here is for you to read less, learn more, and save lives, one spoonful at a time. Thank you.